Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Savage Starlight, the officially unofficial podcast for The Last of Us on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 1, Episode 7, Left Behind. Aaron, the instant take left me a little cold on this episode. I gotta say, I watched it a second time. I listened to the podcast that Druckmann and Mazin put out, and I appreciate it a lot more. So I'm happy to report, I think this is actually a good episode.
How are you feeling? I mean, that's something I said like within 30 seconds of starting instant talk. I'm like, man, I feel like from the tenor of chat that like we were saying like that's a bad episode. I was trying to communicate the fact that like it's a good episode, but it's not the episode we want. It's superfluous. Like the whole point of this
missing a couple pieces. Yeah,
the whole point of this episode is to explain why Ellie decides to stay against all odds to try to fix up Joel.
Right.
But the entire last episode led us to that conclusion that finally they love each other and, you know, you sacrifice for the people you love, for the family. I mean, this has been a theme and, you know, it's not so like if this episode came out on Thanksgiving of this year and they were able to put some snow in the Boston quarantine zone and Riley wore a Santa hat, this would be an all-time beloved classic episode because it would serve its purpose as bonus content to the main story. Inserted after fact, and it's just like, oh, it tells us a little bit of facet that we kind of, you know, but as it serves right now, it's just a, it feels like a throat-clearing exercise to get to where we want to be, which is at the end of the episode. Ellie frantically stitching up Joel. It is a great episode. I think the last half is a lot stronger. Like once they get to the mall and, you know, the teenage kind of romance stuff begins, which I think that's always cute to watch, you know, the like the people sizing each other up, trying to fit, you know, not wanting
really
to expose themselves.
Back, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it's funny to hear like Craig and Neil. Is it Neil? Neil Druckmann. It's funny to hear them talk about, you know, like, you know, how, yeah, everyone goes through this period. You know, I don't know. There's probably like 1 out of 1,000 people just born fucking Chads and Stacys and they just have it all figured out. And it's just the one long slaying session, their life. But for the rest of us, there's a whole bunch of awkward stuff. And oh, my God, do I like them? Do they like me? What if I say I like them and they reject me? What if we add, you know, post-apocalypse to all that? So I really like that stuff. It's entirely additional content. It feels like watching the director's cut of something or the extended edition of something. But I never recommend people watch those. Almost, you know, like I would never say, hey, if you've never seen Lord of the Rings, sit down and watch all of the extended editions. I don't think controversial opinion. I don't think there's good a movie as the theatrical releases. If you're a fan, yeah, it's great. It's more stuff. It's more
fan
stuff.
Service,
but it's not as well paced. There's some odd edits. There's some. So like, yeah, this is a great episode. And again, if it came in the context like we got in a DLC where they and in fact, I think that's what they should have done. They should have gave us a Christmas episode.
Okay. And yeah, after the season is over, just come back and fill in a blank. Like
you just
DLC
have an 8 episode run. Everyone's fucking hyped for it. You're, you know, ten months later. So you're like halfway through probably the development cycle of the next season, and bam, on Thanksgiving you drop a Christmas episode of The Last of Us, and everyone loses their fucking mind. But yeah, I was checking around. It seems like the opinion we had is pretty much what most people think. Like, this is a good episode, but feel like... I mean, that's what I got from kind of trolling around, seeing what people were saying.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, I'm not going to take back my mild... The crowd went mild at this episode, and I think that's appropriate.
No, I definitely liked it better on second watch. I mean, it's telling that, you know, this is a story that's taken from a DLC for the game. It's not... They did not deem it worthy of putting in the mainline game.
And that means downloadable content. That's like the industry term for extra bonus shit you get after you. It's like special features, you know, extended editions.
Uh-huh. Exactly. And so it was something that, you know, while not exactly tacked on to the story, definitely was not there in the original experience. And I think you could get rid of this episode and still understand where Ellie's coming from. But I do think on second watch that this lends a lot of a little bit more understanding to where Ellie's coming from. I mean, the thing that I wasn't really picking up the first time around that I got after listening, and how could I not, after listening to the podcast, the official podcast, is just how much Ellie had not lost anybody yet. How like fresh her spirit was in the time before she lost Riley, and how much this was like the instigating the event for her not trusting anybody or not being able to connect with Joel or anybody in her life. Right. And the contrast between her and Riley in those moments really stood out a lot more to me after having it pointed out. I think it's fairly subtle, because the thing you're looking at more is like, what does this mean with her and Joel? Not how are her and Riley contrasting in these scenes. Mm-hmm. And so I missed that part. And I think it's on second watch when I appreciated it, I thought it was there and really made the episode a lot better.
What's fun. It's like, you know, and I don't want to argue people's subjective opinion, but when you said like, if you remove this episode, you might still be able to understand the main thrust of the series. I think that's an inarguable point. It's not maybe. It's like you would, because definitely. We all played it when it came out and thought it was amazing. And if you interviewed us, I was like, hey, did you think there's anything missing there? We wouldn't have been like, man, I feel like there was a sweet carousel scene that they really left by, and they kind of hinted at this right thing. No one said that. So like, it's 100% possible to enjoy. In fact, that was the preferred creator's vision, to not have this episode. And, you know, like I said, I don't.
But the same is true of episode 3 with Bill and Frank, right? Like, none of that is pertinent to the actual main story
but
of Ellie
and
Joel.
But we got something. I argue that we got a lot about, like, that's the thing that drove me crazy about the criticism. Because if that was just an art piece about, you know, two middle-aged gay dudes authentically loving each other, I would have been a little bit more on board with the, like, oh my God, they're wasting time. Because all of that stuff was supposed to be telling you things about Joel and Ellie, which we pointed out along this episode. This episode does not introduce, I don't think, any new information about Ellie or Joel that you didn't get from the previous episode. That they have finally, they've buried all hatchets. They've made peace with the fact that they're in the situation or in the situation. They like each other. In fact, they love each other. And they've become this kind of like family unit.
Might not be entirely new information, but it does reinforce the things that we've seen, I'm in support of. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, no one's going to, like I said, like, also, let's calm the fuck down. No one's going to rage quit the series because there was a little bit of extraneous content here. Like,
extraneous, but very good, very heartfelt, very affecting content. Yes. Yeah, but.
Yeah, I just think that, like, it's, you know, there's not a right or wrong way to adapt video games yet. I don't think the people have, like, unlocked, and probably just not just one thing. But if I was a creator going forward, I would really wonder if I want, like, how I would approach DLC. And, you know, it's kind of like if you had, you know, a book series that had several prequels and sequels, like, which one would you start with, you know? Would you start with the prequels, even though it's like, I think there's probably an answer that, like, you probably don't release that stuff in chronological information. You probably you release it in the order that the author intended. But so, like, that's the one thing. Like, clearly, I think the other thing that motivated at least Druckmann is he really wanted his carousel scene. He really wanted his arcade scene. Like, for very nostalgic personal reasons, just like, this is such a and it is. It's a beautiful, it is. It's also a departure from the core video game. You know, they mentioned that on the podcast, too, that, like, they wanted to deliberately, as a creative choice, subvert the fact that your experience in The Last of Us was using this controller to maim, kill, and savage. And these same controls that you use to interact with the world will now be used to seduce and romance and delight. And some of the stuff that they learned into making this DLC paid off very handsomely in The Last of Us Part Two, and gave us some really effective scenes because they kind of explored that, you know, like, what if we really lean into some of these non-combat, gentle character developing, you know, exploration type things. And I think it paid dividends, but again, it's not a necessary part of the canon, I would say. And like I said, it's not fatal. It's not bad. It's just, oof, you had so much momentum, And it's not like you've lost all that, but like you've put a pause. You've had to like control and divert that for yet another week. And these next 2 weeks are going to be, I would bet my life on them being all time bangers. So no one's going to care. Mm-hmm. But I do wonder if this was this should have been an 8-episode season. This should have been the Christmas episode. That's all I've got to say.
All right.
That's my thesis.
Sounds
my
good.
Humble thesis.
Well, with that said, why don't we get into the recap?
Yep. Now's the time to endure and survive. We'll be back with more Savage Starlight.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Just so we're clear about back there, it was either us or the ad. Welcome back to more Savage Starlight. Start off with Ellie and Joel. They managed to make it to the basement of a suburban house. I always wondered when I was playing the game how she got him down there. How she got big ass bulky Joel drug into a house and set up on a cot.
Well, he's down
in the game. He's on like a sleeping bag or something, but
he's kind of get him rolling and he'll make it big. If she, if she took him upstairs, I'd be really worried about it. But
a gut wound much good. I could say
she
that
32 feet per second working for her. And,
what's the delta V on a Joel rolling downhill? I don't know.
I don't know. Depends on, is he farting at the apex of the cartwheel because he's going to get a little bit extra thrust on that. You got to count. Uh-huh. You don't want to not account for that force.
I want to know how she just got him out of the snow. I guess she probably attached a rope to his ankle and had the horse pull him or something.
If you want a serious answer, I'm guessing that she cajoled/bullied Joel back into the saddle,
standing
long
up
enough to get him to the outside of the house. And because, if she had I don't think she could hoist Joel onto that horse.
No, definitely.
And I don't
not.
Think she drug him an appreciable different distance. So.
Yeah. It plays out exactly the same way in the game where they just kind of fade to black and then whoop, there you are in the house. You never see her dragging him around. Anyway, while he's trying to help him.
I love the touch of the horse parked in the garage. That's straight out of the video game. And it always made me laugh out loud when you go out there. And the horses parked in the garage, you know.
Horses are the cars of the apocalypse, Aaron. Joel tells her to leave him and go back to Tommy. She covers him in a blanket and then heads out the door, or at least heads to the door, puts her hand on the doorknob.
Yeah. And, you know,
I do wonder if people who haven't played the game thought maybe she is leaving him there in the snow to die.
I don't know. I wish I could brainwash myself. I wish I had a pure Aaron instance I could boot up and have to see, because I feel like, I feel like at this point I would at this point in the game, I was at least medium suspecting that one of the main characters was going to die. Mm-hmm. And we are far enough along. Like, I remember at this point in the game being far enough along thinking that oh my God, it could be, this could be the thing I've been dreading this whole time. So that was my authentic response to the first time I was playing through this. So I imagine there's at least several people that kind of was wondering, especially last week. Now, in the first, if you're asking me 5 instances episode, if they thought that she would leave him at the beginning of this and go through this flashback, and probably not. But at the end of last week, I got to think at least some people were worried for Joel.
With the way the show goes, I mean, it's not exactly the happiest of shows. So
you could see
this tragedy, just as they're starting to connect for real, right? And come to some kind of understanding, boom, one of them's dead.
But it feels like a bittersweet pill, right? Like Joel is the stage one rocket that got her to the research facility, and then they found the cure. Sure. And so it's a bittersweet,
they've peeled off tests. She lost that booster.
Almost every other minor character we've met on the way has died. So it's definitely in the show's DNA to be that kind of hard hitting.
And it's still an open question. He's not out of the woods. She just sewed him up. But
no, right.
She's not going to leave him.
And I think the thing that works in the show's favor is they spent all last week making sure that we knew that Ellie has no chance without Joel. Ellie doesn't think she has a chance. Joel doesn't think she has a chance. Joel just started prepping her to have a chance. If he'd started this 3 months ago, what is she going to do? But we see that, because that's the other thing is you got to remember that Ellie's been through Fedra school on an officer track training. So she does know a lot more basic things. This isn't the first time I think she's sewn a wound or at least practiced doing it, right?
Probably, yeah.
So she's not I'm not going to say she's a battlefield medic or anything, but she's going to take what she knows and she's going to apply it as best she can.
Mm-hmm. All right. Then we start the flashback, which is going to last almost the entire episode. It's Ellie in Fedra school, as you mentioned. She's getting bullied. She's fighting back. And then Captain Kwong plays the school counselor here for a second. I don't know what his actual title is other than Captain. And tells her that she has her choice of two paths. She can either be a grunt and hate her life, or she can get her shit together and become an officer with an easy life and a lot of power. And she chooses the officer path.
It's funny because they're... that's an interesting nuanced opinion that the show has on the Boston quarantine zone. It feels like if any quarantine zone is trying to keep to its original purpose, this one is. Because I think he's probably right, Captain Kwong here. If Fedra falls, the people here are going to starve and murder each other. I think that's right. I think that's right.
Seen it, right? Look at
I think
Kansas
in Kansas
City.
City, they like. I don't think that was headed towards utopia. I think that was a whole bunch of people that broke it into the supply chain, and they were drinking all the booze, and they were eating all the food, and things are going to be great for a couple of weeks, and then, you know, even without the infected coming back, you know. And again, I don't think that like every revolution's doomed to fail, but like it is historically a hard turn to make from like 20 years of fascism into like representational democracy. You know, those that's a rough, it's a hairpin turn for a civilization to make. And this guy seems like he genuinely cares about his charges. You know, he doesn't want to see Ellie kind of throw her life, what life she has. You know, he doesn't want to see her throw, like, this doesn't seem like a jackbooted fascist.
And that's why I appreciate, you know, it's not, they're not taking the easy route of just saying, well, Fedra is evil, so obviously the Fireflies are right.
Right.
And that extends throughout this entire episode where you have...
It sure does.
Ellie, who may or may not buy into... what may or may not be propaganda from Fedra. And then, you know, Riley over on the other side with Fireflies. I really appreciate some of the more subtle work they're doing there, and we'll get to it here in a bit. But yeah, Captain Kwong seems like a decent person. That's what I would call him. He seems decent, which, you know, is in contrast to a lot of the stuff we've seen from Fedra already with hangings for what seem to be minor offenses. I don't want to throw the KC stuff in there because that's a different group.
Right.
But yeah, the stuff we've seen here is not amazing either. But then we see scenes like this.
Yeah.
So we're left to wonder.
And they cast Terry Chin as Captain Kwong here. I think, you know, mostly know him from The Expanse, where he seemed to be this very calm, gentle,
compassionate,
very empathetic, and I think he took that exact effect and tone into this role. So I was already like, oh, this is Prax, he's a good guy. That's all that. The casting is part of it, right? So I think the show, this whole episode is wanting us to kind of, you know, pump the brakes on what we know about Fedra and the Fireflies and kind of make our own decision, because we'll have someone we really, really like and respect, Ellie, taking some shots at him in this episode.
Yeah, and I'm bringing a lot of that Expanse baggage too, where he's also got that like dead-eyed killer mode when he's challenged enough, which I really like. And this is also the scene, one of the things he says to her here is, we're the only thing holding all this together. And you're going to see that come back later in the episode in a way that I find really interesting. Like, if we go down, people in the zone will murder each other. All that stuff is about to come back. Did you notice on the desk here when he throws this keychain, what's on it?
The Naughty Dog logo, right?
Yeah.
It's funny, I watched this episode two more times, but I still didn't notice it, even though people pointed it out in the live.
It's that paw print.
Yeah.
A little Easter egg there.
In case you don't know, that's the developer of the original The Last of Us, as well as all the Uncharted. They're kind of a big deal in video game circles.
Yeah, especially in story-based video games. They're one of the highest profile companies doing that stuff.
Gosh, it's amazing. Like, they must have nothing to do with adapting the Uncharted movie. Because like that failed to capture the spirit and the feeling of playing an Uncharted game in exactly the opposite way that this is nailing it. Bad Drake, bad Sully.
I do wonder if it comes down in some part to the studio or let's say the studio or publisher who's doing the adaptation, because one of the things I took away from the podcast this week is HBO actually has their hands quite a bit in the shows. And I feel like the tone I got was HBO suggested some things, suggested, not demanded, just suggested, I guess, to Craig and Neil to do certain things a little bit more, like to tie back Ellie's stuff to Joel's stuff, to the flashback to the modern day a lot more than they had originally in their script.
Which stuns me that they were just
right because it's such an awesome. It's almost obvious, right? Like, isn't that kind of what you want to do with this?
Like, you already have this detached storyline. You're just going to completely cut it adrift. No intro, outro sequel. Yeah.
Right. Tie it back. Give us something to anchor in the story we're already interested in. And that came from HBO. So I'm thinking, like, maybe on the Uncharted games, they didn't have that. Or they had the opposite. Mm. They had the companies that were publishing this thing suggesting, hey, why don't you do this thing? And it's actually not a good idea. Or it's going to make it more popular and not better. Like, hey, we want a big action scene here or something. It feels like HBO, over the course of their history here, over decades, has honed their storytelling craft and is using that to help the people that they hire to write these stories. And it shows, because basically everything that comes out of HBO is quality. And they give their creators freedom and hire the best, right? That helps too.
And sounds like a lot of positive feedback too.
Mm-hmm. All right. That night, Riley sneaks into Ellie's dorm room while she's reading Savage Starlight, tells her she's a firefly, then invites her to have the best night of her life. Ellie initially refuses, but eventually relents.
So I looked at this Savage Starlight issue, and I think it is roughly analogous to the last. It's kind of like the last episode.
Oh, okay.
That because you've got this Dr. Starlight character and the Captain, whatever. I think he's the Dr. Starlight's supposed to be kind of roughly Ellie, and the Captain character is supposed to be kind of roughly Joel. And the Joel character is saying we got to leave this area right now. And the Ellie character is saying the sensors say that it's down this path. Should we knock? And then Joel character says I got my door knocker. It's this big laser blaster. And they blow this ornate door down. She turns the page and the Joel analog says, all right, ladies, stand down. But he's speaking into an empty dark room. And the Ellie analog says they're not here. I think that's supposed to correspond to the going to that university and, you know, expecting to find somebody and there was no one there.
Okay.
But anyway, it's speaking of loosely connected material, Savage Starlight is not exactly... You find them all and then you understand The Last of Us at a deeper level. It's just an Easter egg. But again, love seeing the name out there.
Yeah, for sure. And seeing that they actually made an issue of this comic was kind of cool, because knowing that in the games they were nothing but front and back covers, they took a little more care in this. Another thing that I really love about this scene is we've talked about like their environmental storytelling, but I think they're using a lot of different techniques here to great effect. One of them being... I didn't get in the first watch, I must have been like looking down, taking notes or something, that Riley was probably Ellie's roommate. But there's a shot in this that tells you that without telling you that. It's just Ellie looking over at the empty bed in the other corner of the room. And just like, oh.
That tracks.
Wow, yeah. That's Riley's bed, right?
Yeah.
It's something quick and subtle, but it says so much.
I imagine the scene maybe probably gave the people who are tracking how much noise people make fits, because like they made so much noise when it's supposed to be 2 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, did they have adults watching these kids at all? Because there was like a full on confrontation, a scuffle, a Donnybrook in Ellie's room, and nobody checks it out. Like people body slammed onto the floors. Yeah. Anyway, maybe there's like 16 inch thick cement floors and walls. Like these are like bank vaults. Type of place you could practice the drums in and not even disturb the upstairs neighbor.
Sure. It didn't seem like the doors had much soundproofing, because when the person comes by and yells lights out, it's pretty
audible.
This is true. Anyway, I was wondering how bad these Fedra schools are. We certainly heard horror stories about Kansas City, but when Riley sneaks in, I'm wondering... You know, Ellie freaks out, rightfully so. Someone's trying to abduct her in the middle of the night. Does she think this is Bethany coming back for revenge, or does she think this is something worse?
I mean, who knows? Like, because I imagine this Casey, world, it's probably bad news for anyone. I mean, in our world, it's bad news for someone to wake you up with their hand over your mouth. So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
It felt I was surprised at how school. Like, I talked about how Ella probably, you know, you see where Joel's living and it's like, you know, a shooting gallery. It's a place where, you know, unhoused people would gather to shoot. That's what it looks like. It's grimy. There's, you know, the paint's all peeling. The windows are on bad repair. The carpet's all torn up. I thought Ellie's school looked kind of like a boarding school.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was noticeably better maintained than what the, you know, what Joel was kind of slumming in.
Yeah, for sure. Which is hilarious if you think back to last episode where she's like, yeah, we've been staying in some real shitholes.
Right. Yeah.
Joel's just used to it. He's just like, yeah, that's normal. But Ellie was staying in a decent place.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like it was pitched perfectly to where Ellie would still find like Frank and Bill's place shocking in its opulence and its comfort and hominess, but not the bombed out shithole that they've been sleeping in, you know, since she's been with Joel.
So it was nice. She doesn't have like a dorm room bunk bed with a writing desk and all that stuff. She just has a nightstand and a bunch of posters.
Right, right.
So when she sees, I don't know, credenzas and all this shit that he's got and china cabinets.
Nice, tasteful paintings and drapes and matching bedspreads, yeah.
Oh, the other thing she has in her room, I really like this touch, is Riley looks at it. It's an Aha Hits tape, which lets you know, hey, this is one of Ellie's favorite bands, or at least... Let's say it's one of the tapes she could get her hands on, so she's familiar with it. That's why you hear a lot of Aha in this episode when Riley's trying to give her the night of her life.
Did you think that? What do you think of the Pearl Jam stuff? You're more of a music guy than me.
I'm not very familiar with the song at all. I'm more of like the Craig Mazin to somebody out there's Neil Druckmann who knows this song intimately. But I deeply felt what he was talking about, right? Like everybody has that song that takes you back and it was like a comfort song for you. A song that meant a lot to you, that got you through, you know, whether it was actual hard times or just like felt like hard times because you were a teenager and everything's crazy. That song, that idea really resonated with me. And apparently this is one of those songs for Neil Druckmann.
Yeah. It's funny because just coincidentally, I decided to, because I was reading a Reddit thread about what are albums that have no skippable songs, no terrible songs. And someone mentioned Pearl Jam's 10.
Yep.
I'm like, yeah, that was a fucking banger. So this weekend I was doing some handyman work around the house and I was listening to that. And I'm like, God, yeah, this is. I forgot, like, you know, I had this album, very familiar to stuff that played on the radio. But some of the, I guess, B-side stuff, just, incredible album. But I guess this was on their that was their debut album. This is on the 2002 follow up. So still hasn't been Cordyceps. Got at least two albums out of Pearl Jam. No anachronisms detected thus far.
Do you have any albums like that you think are perfect? I've got one that comes to mind. I'm sure there are a ton.
There's
of them.
A bunch. Like if we're just going to talk about music now, you know, another one again, same period, like Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill.
Oh,
where's the bad song on that fucker? I think they all were like number one singles at some point too. Like that might be
most of them.
I think another flawless album is Blackalicious's Blazing Arrow. That has no bad album songs on the entire album. I can make an argument for like Melancholy and Infinite Sadness. There's some.
Ooh, that's going to be divisive. I would agree. I love that album. I can listen to it. Double album. I can listen to it straight through. But Siamese Dream is the one for me.
Yeah, that would probably be the one if you want to go nothing but bad. You're right. I think all the melancholy stuff is at least interesting. Like,
oh, yeah.
Like rage skip or something.
Yeah, there are a lot of them. But
we had a golden chance
to
bust out our DJ voices when we were talking about what's your favorite number one nostalgic album? count it down for us at number five, man. Jim's personal favorite album.
I don't think Ellie has ever heard that voice. Ellie doesn't know what DJ voice is.
That's true. Oh my God. Mankind's gonna have to rediscover the DJ voice when they get terrestrial radio back.
Honestly, most of Gen Z probably doesn't know what the DJ voice is. They've just been listening to Spotify. So
it's true. It's true.
They know what ads sound like.
Tell us how telegraphs worked, Grandpa.
Mm-hmm. All right. Maybe we should move on. Yeah. We're showing our age here. Ellie and Riley walk and talk about Ellie's fight with Bethany. They go into a building where they find a dead guy and steal his booze before he falls through the floor. They take the booze to the rooftop and drink together while debating Fireflies versus Fedra. And then they continue on, jumping from roof to roof.
There's like some kind of interesting illusion where, because is this a natural feature Bella has that her one of her eyebrows is just fucked up? I think it is.
I don't think so, because Ellie has that in the game too, right? So I imagine.
So maybe they did do, because I was thinking, like, I was thinking back, it's like, I wouldn't bet that she didn't have it in Game of Thrones, because of course she would. I started thinking it was like, sure. Like I forgot. Or I guess I forgot that Ellie has that eyebrow scar, but we kind of have a little bit of lore about the 7-Eleven situation is where she got her eyebrow mangled. Yeah. There's
Bella
a little
Ramsey
bit of
has
this.
Both of her eyebrows fully intact. So fully no intact 7-Eleven eyebrows. Situation for real life Bella.
Good for you, Bella. Good. You just hold on those brows, kid.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit of that kind of jousting at the sexuality, you know, like Ellie mm-hmm. Putting forth, oh, did you meet some Firefly stud and get Twitter-pated? And also the qualification of the chick to pop out of nowhere is like, was she like young? It's like, I don't know. It's like 40 or 50. Old.
Yeah, whatever. So, old.
So funny.
It's good. I really want to know more about the 7-Eleven situation. They were very coy about it in the podcast, and I assume that's because they don't really know what it is, but they wanted to throw something in there.
There is a graphic novel that's called like Americana or Coming Back to America or something. That is like a prequel to Left Behind.
This. I haven't read it yet.
I bet the 7-Eleven incident is contained within that.
Could
that
be
comic. Well, if you got it, read it and then give it to me so I can read it.
Well, it's digital. It's on my iPhone, so.
Oh.
Or my iPad.
Okay. Well, gee, how would you ever get me a copy, Jim?
I legit don't know. I bought it from the Apple store, so it's probably DRM'd to hell and back.
Okay. Yeah, no, you're probably right.
I imagine this might also potentially be something from Neil Druckmann's actual life, right? He's putting so much personal stuff into both the game and also this show, and specifically this episode, with the Pearl Jam song, with Joel wanting to be a singer, right? With Ellie being kind of just a shitty student. He talks about how he was, which was exactly like me, man. I never identified harder with somebody than when he's talking about, I just didn't care about school. I never did homework. I passed every test and got, you know, D's just enough not to flunk out. But I imagine there might be something to this 7-Eleven situation in his real life. If you really pressed him.
We got to check his headshot. What's his eyebrow status? Eyebrows intact and Neil Druckmann?
I don't know. We could find out.
We got some savage eyebrows.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, here's where the stuff with Captain Kwong comes back. Where Ellie's trying to defend Fedra. And I'm not sure exactly why she's trying to defend Fedra. Maybe she just doesn't like, she's been filled with ideas about what the Fireflies are, and for good reason. I mean, they are.
No, she's in Fedra
people.
School. She's been indoctrinated that Fireflies are bad. And there is evidence that Fedra, like, if this was 100% a fascist hellhole, if they needed new places to live, they would just increase the criminality of petty offenses and hang a bunch of more people and find places to put them. You know?
Sure, sure.
The fact that they are rehabilitate, going to the trouble to clear out, rehabilitate, and wire for electricity additional blocks suggests that they are. And the fact that, you know, Captain Kwong is concerned with the fact that, you know, this continues to maintain that people get a chance to live, you know, that they can make it through this. I don't think they're all bad.
No, of course. Of course. I mean, they are providing a valuable service. We talked about this in the first episode.
Yeah, with rare exception on this planet, actually, most governments, even if you think of like the most repressive, brutal ones you can think of, have some things that they like. It, at some point, you have to take care of your citizens or what the hell, you know, the whole thing stops working. It would shock me if Fedra wasn't like that as well. And, you know, Ellie's certainly only got their side. But then again, clearly, I don't think Riley is scoring. It's actually really hard to score to Firefly's morality against the Fedras, you know, like,
oh, especially when you're what, 16, maybe, with Riley.
Sure. You know, you're like, you're bombing and killing random people, but it's in the service of getting rid of Fedra, which is hanging probably innocent people. It's really murky.
Yeah, the thing I love about this scene, though, is what Ellie says in defense of Fedra, which is exactly what Captain Kwong told her, right? Like, if we weren't here, the place would fall apart and people would start killing each other. This is indoctrination, right? This is her saying something that she has heard someone with authority say, even though I don't think herself actually understands it very deeply.
Yeah.
She's spouting something, regurgitating something that somebody else said.
But there's also the truth to, like, when, you know, they're say, well, Fedra shouldn't, you know, you shouldn't bomb innocent civilians. Well, Fedra shouldn't hang them. Well, Fedra shouldn't starve its citizens. Well, you blowing up the supply depot didn't help out any. You know, this is it dovetails in like Andor, right? The whole rebellion. When we watch Star Wars movies, we just get that they're the heroes. But Andor kind of like, what does a rebellion actually look like? What is it, you know?
What's the cost of a lot the rebellion?
It's a lot of making lives shitty for everyday people so that they are jolted out of their apathy and complacency. That's like revolutionary / terrorism 101, right?
Yeah.
And it looks like that's what, you know, like that probably did not serve the people of Boston to bomb the supply depot. But it will make life harder, which will make Fedra's life harder, which will make them easier to target, which will eventually get to a place where you can replace it with representational democracy and all problems will be solved.
Sure, sure. As long as you have the right people ready to go when the time comes to make the change.
Yep. Well, it's a good thing the right people will be making those choices, Jim.
All right. Riley and Ellie arrive at a sealed off, quote unquote, sealed off mall. They make their way inside. Riley turns on the power for the entire mall, surprising Ellie with a dazzling display of lights, and then promises to show Ellie the four wonders of the mall. They encounter an escalator, which thrills Ellie so much that she dubs it the first wonder of the mall, even though it was not on Riley's list of four wonders.
Now there's a hastily added five wonders of the mall.
Yeah, I love it. Like, the disparity between like what Riley knows she's got coming up for Ellie and Ellie's amazement at kind of the simplest of things, right? Just like her expectations of being blown away are so low. By the time she gets to the arcade, she never even dreamed that there could be an arcade. So this escalator's thrilling.
I gave the production design the benefit of the doubt on the instant cast because we're talking about how did this light and sound not draw anyone from the outside? And I'm like, well, they did, you know, mention that this was like I thought that there's some kind of Chernobyl style sarcophagus over the whole structure because it was so overrun. As far as I can tell, that's not true. Like,
they don't show shit.
It's built like a bank vault, but it also has what looks like to be giant vaulted skylights running down the entire center of the promenade of this mall. And that to the fact that like the entire second floor of this mall is fictional, like the mall that they used around Calgary only had the one floor. So they essentially just painted this bright green ring around the roof and everything above that. What Ellie's looking out over here, they built a railing, a physical railing for it. Everything else you see is digital. So it feels like a self-inflicted gunshot wound that like they're saying like, oh, don't worry. There's, you know, this is like a bank vault in here. But I'm looking down these enormous, like I'm looking over your head. You've got that as your backdrop. Like there's huge skylights, man. Like there's got to be day glow, fuchsia, green. It's just shit filtering through that. Not to mention the power drain that this must be putting on.
Oh, yeah.
Fedra's beleaguered power generation system. Not the reason why I'm a little cool on this episode. It's just feels like an unforced error.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I didn't notice that in the first watch, but yeah, on second watch, they just wanted to be this grand kind of mall, right? Because they had an actual mall they were shooting in, but it was a single story mall, and they were like, eh, it's kind of a sad mall.
But see, most contemporary,
I don't know why it needed to be so big,
most
though.
North American malls didn't have this giant skylight, and
absolutely,
this mall did not either. So the thing to do would just be to have it be. Because, yeah, like most malls, like the windows are in the front of the stores. The back of the store is like cinder block. Like I would believe.
Yeah, every mall is not Mall of America, right? Like you.
Exactly.
It was not until, I want to say, like the late 90s that they started building these extravagant,
the really
over-the-top,
Taj Mahal,
beautiful malls.
Yeah.
I remember when Sears was the fucking anchor store. I remember when Kohl's was the fanciest thing you'd find at one of the malls here.
I remember service merchandise was the anchor store. If you want to go, they could have just gone with the conventional, like, you know, bomb style mall, but they didn't though.
Uh-huh.
I'm guessing everyone in Fetters goes to sleep. It's late,
including the guy watching the dials on the electricity.
Yeah,
because my God. Power drain.
Use the less. That's when you use the least amount of power at night, so you don't notice it going missing.
Mm-hmm. And you get to hear some aha while they're riding the escalator here, which I couldn't tell. Was that supposed to be diegetic? Was that supposed to be in the scene or just part of the soundtrack?
Honestly, I thought they missed another opportunity to have her wire Ellie's thing into the mall sound system. Like,
right? She's already at the power junction there. Why don't just have her? Maybe she did, but they don't take the Walkman with them if they do, right? They just
The Walkman shows up later in the episode too. So like, I think it's really, you know,
here it is. I figured it out. So she does plug it in here. They walk away from the Walkman, but when Ellie leaves, Riley runs up to the power station, grabs the Walkman, and then goes to the Halloween store. Yeah.
Sprints. Usain bolts her way to the thing, grabs it, comes back. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It feels like they were going very much the rule of cool. Like they even made fun of the fact that they have Depeche Mode, or was it Depeche Mode, or what is the one that the carousel is playing?
The Cure.
No, it's The Cure. Mm-hmm. Just Like Heaven. They even point, it's like, you know, what fucking carousel has ever played this kind of like calliope version, this circus music version of this? And they're like, it sounded good. I liked it. I've had this track for years and I finally found a use for it. So fair enough.
And you get a lot of just kind of background stuff here. The Dawn of the Wolf Part 2 coming soon. I thought that was an interesting poster. The sign on what might be the movie theater, I can't be sure, says back in 5 minutes, and it's been there for 20 plus years, right?
Yeah, I thought that was funny.
I love that.
Oh, video game Easter eggs. I called some of these out on the instant take, but there's a scene of like Ellie jiggling the flashlight to get the to get the batteries to kind of connect. There was a mechanic in the old, I think this is even back in the PlayStation 3 version, where they had the 6-axis controllers. And every once in a while, your flashlight would gutter out and you'd have to take the controller and like bang it against your thigh or jiggle it to get the batteries to go again. So that was kind of cute. And then also Ellie getting her eyes blasted with the light and like squinting. I think
this show has a lot of balls, let me tell you, with last episode where it's going from pure black to driven white snow. Yeah, you got a lot of balls talking about light in your eyes, show.
See, that was just another Easter egg. That was like so you could be inside Ellie's eyes when they get blasted with the flashlight. But that's, yeah, in most video games, characters are not reactive that way to light or really anything.
Mm-hmm.
And The Last of Us on characters, like they are. Like, I think they react if you shoot close to them or if you, certainly if you shine lights in their eyes, they kind of like shield their eyes and squint. And I thought those are some cute Easter eggs for the video game players.
Mm-hmm. All right, they continue through the mall. They stop to wonder why anyone would want lingerie or sneakers. Eventually, they reach the real first wonder, which is a fully working carousel. And they ride it for a bit before it stops working. And then Ellie floats the idea of Riley coming back to school so they can one day run Fedra and change things for the better. but that's not really possible for Riley because she already knows what Fedra thinks of her. They literally think she's shit.
You know, I gotta say, I thought sewer detail would involve actually handling sewage, but it, I guess yeah. Fedra's sewer detail is just guarding the people who are handling sewage. So it wasn't as bad as I thought when I heard, but like, yeah, that's literally a shit job. You know, when Captain Quan was talking about eating shit food and sleeping in a shit bunk and having a shit job, literally a shit job.
Would you rather have the shit detail or the corpse detail?
Honestly, the corpse detail. I would much rather handle dead bodies than bodies. Shit. Bacon. I've actually heard that human beings smell
bacon?
Very much like, yeah.
Sign
like,
me up.
It's like we're very close to the pork in our musculature and fat. Yeah, that's true. I've heard that certain cannibal societies have referred to humans as long pork.
Neither of those jobs seems great. I'd rather have Captain Kwong's job.
But I know what shit smells like, and if I'm right about corpses, it kind of smells delicious. So I'll go with that.
Watch out. Watch out. I don't like the way you're talking, Aaron.
You know, I didn't agree with Craig Mazin's take on Ellie's reaction to the Victoria's Secrets mirror either. Like he was saying that she was her reflection was literally in front of one of the angel posters and she was seeing her inadequacies compared to that. He might be right. I didn't understand.
That was my initial idea, too.
I didn't understand 14-year-old girls when I was in high school, you know, at the time, let alone now. But I thought that it was more of like when Riley put it into her head, like, imagine you wearing something like that, that like slight sexualization suddenly made her self-conscious about, you know, smoothing her appearance. Cause she was getting, she's trying to like get up the courage to make that first step to kiss her. So, you know, that's what you do. Check your breath. you lick your thumbs, you put them on your eyebrows, you check your hair, you know, just make sure you're nice and, you know, whatever you got, it's presented the way you want it.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both, right? Like, she does all that. She's, like, trying to spiff herself up, and she kind of sees, you know, this poster of this supermodel in lingerie and goes, ah, shit, I'm not that. But I don't know that that's what Riley is looking for, you know? Neither of them see the point of any of this. So
I don't know that like what you would deal with a beauty standard like that if you've grown, because that's where like I felt like Craig was taken in like, oh, I am a 21st century person who's washed in this sexist sales culture. Bella's a person that's, you know, grown up with people wearing Goodwill clothes and malnourished and not in good I wonder if you would even register that as beautiful. Like, I mean, yeah, of course you would. But kind of like when you see like a Renaissance painting of what's supposedly a beautiful woman and you're like,
sure,
oh, that's your hair and your makeup, girl. What's going on here? You know, I wonder if you would like go in, you'd see an angel, a Victoria's Secret angel. You would, if you're a 14-year-old girl, you'd be like, oh, God, I'm supposed to look like that. Or you'd be like, that's fucking wild. So I don't know. I could be wrong.
Yeah. I mean, it's an impossible standard today. In the apocalypse?
Sure.
Good fucking luck, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. It's almost sad in a way that she like sees this and is somehow thinking she has to measure up to it. But none of that's gonna matter. I think, you know, by the end of this episode, it's clear how they feel about each other. And we find out that like not only did Kwong, not only is shit detail a thing, but that's why Riley ran away. At least that's the initial reason she ran away, is because she got a glimpse into her future life. That was what she was going to be doing, and she didn't like it.
Also, I wondered on, I think my third watch, I was like, why isn't Riley considered for leadership? If like maybe she's got a bad attitude towards authority. It seems like Ellie has that in spades. It seems like she's intelligent and resourceful.
Yeah, what about her?
Gotta be. There's. I mean, like, you gotta have residual racism, right? Like, is 20 years in the apocalypse enough to weld us together into one human species?
Probably not.
Or is Captain Kwong? Captain Kwong got a little, you know, just doesn't see Riley as management material.
Right. Maybe. I would say shame on you, dude. It's not like you haven't experienced some racism in your time. I don't know. I don't know if that's the reason, but you're right. There doesn't seem to be a big difference between, let's say, the intelligence, the resourcefulness, the will of any of these kids. So
if you wanted to say that the Boston Quarantine Zone is living in a post-racial society, then it could be that Kwong gave this speech to Riley 2 years ago, and Riley is like, double middle finger, fuck you, I'm going to continue getting thrown in a hole, and, you know, whereas Kwong's trying to, like, you know, maybe offer, like, what I'm saying is maybe offer to both, and, like, because it does seem, all other things being equal, that Riley is a lot more anti-Fedra than
she is, and she is the fighter, right? I get the impression that she has not been in one
although
fight,
that's crazy to be like, oh yeah, right, between Ellen and Riley, Riley's the fighter,
right.
Is she the fighter because she's just bigger and stronger, because she's, you know, she's two, at least almost 2.5 years older than Ellie. So I don't know, it seems like Ellie's pretty fierce
when she needs to be, but she didn't really need to be before this, right?
Showed that stuck-up Bethany bitch a thing or two in the infirmary, didn't she?
Mm-hmm. Fuck Carol and fuck Bethany. Both
damn
of them.
Damn straight.
All right, let's get to the second wonder, or third, depending on how you're counting them. Riley and Ellie strike poses with each other in a photo booth. Riley gives Ellie the photos, and then they move on. Riley really leaning into Ellie on that scary pose. This is where I started to say, like, okay, maybe there's something to this from both sides. Because before this, I wasn't getting much from Riley. But this is the scene that was like, she's into her.
The fact that she's doing
even
all
here,
this. Yeah. Like, I mean, I would probably do something like this for you if you were going away for a long time. I'd probably put some thought into, like, your, but, like, at 16, no fucking way, dude.
Yeah.
Be like, if I was doing this for going away, I'd be trying to fuck you for 100%. So.
Well, I better not go away then. Sorry, not interested.
Yeah, we do not want to tempt this sexual inferno that we've been fighting for 12 years. We don't want to put ourselves into a compromising position. Or passions will take their course.
Do photo booths still exist?
Yes. Yeah, they do. I just did one this summer at, I think, Cedar Point. It's always stuff like that. They've got them at, like, you know, Chuck E. Cheese's, still the malls. You can usually find them.
Oh, yeah. It's a perfect
amusement
place.
Parks, things like that. Yeah.
I imagine they're probably more popular now than they were maybe 15 years ago, right?
Yes, because, like, it's seen as a retro, cool thing.
And you can take all the selfies you want with your camera, but there's something cool about having the actual film developed right there in front of you.
Having your bestie in the photo strip on the dream board, or
you can hang on your wall.
That's a statement, 100%.
Have we seen Ellie with these photos? I could have sworn we saw these photos once before.
You might
be wrong.
You might be right, but I don't. I couldn't swear to that.
Yeah, same here.
Because, again, I didn't play. I went and I didn't have time to, because I wanted to rewatch a playthrough, but they're all like 4 or 5 hours long. I instead read the Wikipedia to refresh my memory, because, again, I hadn't played this since it first came out over 10 years ago. So
That's just gonna be the broad strokes, though. The actual plot, not details.
Although,
like,
it was enough for me, because I thought that they left a lot out. The other thing is, the Wikipedia blended the comic book information pretty freely. It was, like, set off by, like, you know, headers and whatnot, but, like, I couldn't quite tell where the comics ended and the DLC began. But
gotcha.
There's a little bit more. I'm gonna stop right there, in case they bring some of that material in, because it wouldn't surprise me if some of that material makes it into the final episode or two.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if we ever revisit this, because, like I said in the instant take, one of the things that I felt negatively about this episode is it stopped before it got to some of the stuff that I'm really curious about. I think it stopped appropriately for the emotional beats of this relationship that was developing and for the Ellie Joel stuff. But man, if I could just see how Ellie handled Riley turning, how she met up with Marlene and got captured effectively by the Fireflies. I'm so curious about that stuff, but yeah, maybe they'll come back to it. I seriously doubt it, though, given what I know about the pace of the next two episodes.
All right.
We'll see.
Mildly interesting.
So we go to the fourth wonder. It's Raja's Arcade, which is straight out of the game. They bust into a change machine, play a few rounds of Mortal Kombat 2. Somewhere else in the mall, we see the first hints of danger. An infected person stirs. They have a ton of fun. Ellie almost kisses Riley, but chickens out and then claims she has to go home. But Riley convinces her to stay by saying she got her a gift. We'll get to that in a second.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool. It's an arcade. It's very nostalgic. I'm old enough to remember when arcades were dingy basement affairs full of smoke in the late 70s and early 80s. This is kind of like the prototypical mid 90s arcade, you know, very neon and brightly colored. And
this is more my arcade for sure.
Yeah. And now they're like Dave and Buster's, kind of like that's the last refuge of this stadium sized arcade. But it's like such a cool thing. Like when you were a kid and you're like with your mom, you're doing back to school shopping, or they're doing whatever stupid adult shit and you're stuck and like, oh, and you're too old for the playscape anymore, but you turn the corner and one of these things shows up and you're like, oh my God, can I have $5 or can I have $1, can I have whatever? And you know that for the next 30 minutes, you don't have to do stupid shit. Like it's a nice feeling. Like the sound, like I love that. They're like, she's like, shh, listen. And you can hear the arcade like a casino pit, you know, dinging and danging. And
absolutely. It's cool. A casino for kids for sure. You just can't win any money. It's all take. No,
you can win fucking tickets and exchange it for goods. So it's really just so, casinos with extra steps, if we're being honest.
That's the thing. Like, so that used to be relegated to like a Showbiz Pizza, a Chuck E. Cheese, those kind of places with the ticket redemption. Arcades took a very interesting evolutionary path where they went from like a place you go to play games for no return, but fun.
Yeah.
And then the ticket game started coming in. And now you've got like, you go to an arcade now, it's a lot of digital stuff where you've got like just screens on tables.
Phone games, giant tablet games,
Flappy Bird on a giant machine or that kind of thing. And a lot of like coin gambling type stuff where you like drop the coin in and try and push a bunch of other coins off the edges. Right.
My favorite
to collect those.
That fucking bit me hard this last year.
Yeah. I love them and I hate them, you know.
I spent $140 getting all 10 cards of the Willy Wonka set, which is worth 10,000 tickets. So I think technically I'm money ahead.
All right. But did you actually want those Willy Wonka cards, or was it just
the thing is, like, that when I got them, I was going to my plan was to give them to like my nieces and nephews and like have them go crazy. But I had so many like secondary cards that are worth like 1,000 tickets a piece that I just was able to get, you know, have my nieces and nephews just shrieking in delight at this bounty. And I still had my original set. And I'm like, you know what? I think I'm going to like I think I want to start collecting these every year. King's Island will start to win the new set. I'm going to have like do something stupid with them, like frame them. So,
yeah,
definitely not money ahead, but it's something super addictive about. Never been into the one-arm jack, but like, man, seeing a big old pile of coins push off and get you to car. It's oof. Dopamine hits, baby.
I'm with you. But yeah, this is very much my experience where it's like a mix of. I will say they had a lot of older arcade games in this arcade. This is not a typical 2003 arcade. Robotron was a very old game at this time.
They like would Quantums have Mortal Kombat 3 at least. They would have something besides Daytona, probably.
I mean, this looks like a shitty mall that shut down in like 1998 and had just been sitting there for six years doing nothing.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know. It's close enough for me.
It's funny that the game did not have the Mortal Kombat license. So they did a game that's clearly Mortal Kombat, but it's called Slicers or some shit like that.
Sure, sure.
But here they got Mortal Kombat 2. They're actually playing it. Craig brought up something interesting in the main cast. Like in this mid-90s situation, there wasn't internet. So like the only way to discover that this game actually, it wasn't like there was something on the art that said, hey, you can kill people after you beat them in this game. You can rip their heads off and do all this other crazy shit. You had to discover that on your own and pass through word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Like there had to be some smelly kid at the arcade hanging out telling you like, oh, you got to do forward, forward, back, light jab, punch. And then
or
turn
more
into a
likely,
dragon and
you get your ass kicked enough by that guy, and then he finishes you 94 times in a row.
Right,
takes all your lunch money, and then you're like, "Man, how did you do that?" And he finally takes pity on you and tells you, shows you one of the moves.
But it was like, yeah, you could if your home small hometown didn't have cool enough kids, you would never discover the secrets of Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, I also have to think that none of these machines would work. Arcade machines are so finicky. Pinball machines are so finicky. 20 years sitting in a dingy.
Of showing that about a third of the cabinets were not working. Like there was definitely ones, and a lot of them were like the screens had lost vertical hold. And, but like, yeah, like, you know, Mortal Kombat, maybe it survives. They only played two games, right? She sat in the Daytona and they played the Mortal Kombat.
Yeah. Anyway, this explains, you know, why Riley or why Ellie would know all about like Melina and what moves she has when her and Joel come up on that arcade machine later.
Her cartoon bone vomit move.
Mm-hmm.
How long do you think the dormant runner was lying there?
I assume weeks, but
just weeks?
I don't really know.
Okay. I wondered that myself because he's not. I feel like I saw some feedback flow. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but I thought that if an infected was kind of like shroomed up into a wall, that they were dried out and desiccated. They're not.
They're now part of the network, but not mobile.
Yeah, and it's like the way. And I've always maintained that like if a runner dies, like they have to still be breathing. Their heart has to be. I might be able to slow down, but like the way they had this person portray being infected and like it just gasped to life, it felt like that thing was dead and it was reactivated by the mushrooms. Is that how you read it too, or do you think he was maybe in very slow, like one heartbeat per minute,
one
respiration per 5 minutes, and
I don't think dead infected can come back to life, so it must have been like a semi-hibernation kind of thing. Here's the missed opportunity for me is we've seen what the network of you know, mycelium or whatever coming out can actually do when you step on a piece of it over here, and it can activate stuff over there. Have them step on something, because this is a flashback. This is before they knew all that, right? Like that would be super interesting that Ellie not only should have known, but actually triggered it one time and didn't realize it.
Yeah, as much as I patted him on the back for coming up with the network idea, the tendril idea, I don't think they've used it very well, because I think that the way they conceive it is it'll bring every infected within a X amount of square radius on top of you. And the way this show is doing a little bit more grounded and realistic, they're not going to throw like 50 infected at two teenage girls and expect them to fight and win. Like there's another small spoiler for the video game. There's a hell of a lot more infected that these girls have to deal with in the video game than there is.
It's not like
one runner is a boss fight for them. Right.
Yeah, I thought it was a missed opportunity with the network.
Yeah, well, but I think they kind of painted themselves in a corner, because when you step in a tendril, you expect like the fucking world to collapse on them because they're in the, you know, the Boston quarantine zone. But yeah, they could have gotten away. And I thought it would be really cool, because they kept on making it a point that Riley had been waiting to do this with Ellie. And it'd been cool, like, if there was a vine that had kind of grown into the carousel and they'd, like, have a close-up of when it starts to spin, that vine snap. Like, that would have been... And then you, like... And because, like, I also... Yeah, I also thought they did a good job of, like, they showed the thing wake up, because my thing is, like, why isn't that on their ass? But then they completely moved to a different part of the mall. Mm-hmm. So it probably went to the arcade to figure out what the fuck was going on there, didn't see them, and then kind of just went into general hunt mode, and it took him the rest of the episode until it finally tracked him back down. But yeah. I thought that'd have been sweet too, if they'd integrated the tendrils, because honestly, I'd almost forgotten about it.
Uh-huh.
Until I started thinking in the second watch, like, yeah, where the fuck are he's surrounded by tendrils. Where are these in the mall? But
yeah, I don't know.
Maybe he's literally the only one in there.
That's what I'm thinking.
And they did
yeah.
such a good job sealing it off that, like, that is the tendril network. It's just not uh-huh. big enough.
Yeah, probably so.
Watch out for that fungus. We'll be right back with more Savage Starlight.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations, while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
We found something to fight for. This podcast. Welcome back to Savage Starlight. Anyway, they go over to Macho Nacho, where Riley gives Ellie Volume 2 of No Pun Intended. We saw Volume 1 earlier on her nightstand in the Fedra School. And I think Volume 2 is what she whips out with Joel later.
Mm-hmm.
They try a few puns out before Ellie spots a bunch of bombs that Riley's been guarding.
Ellie gets pissed and leaves. Riley runs after her and says this is her last night in Boston. Ellie attempts to subtly find out if there's anything between them and then storms off when Riley refuses to acknowledge it. It's very subtle, though. It's not like she says, hey, what do you think of me? It's more like she's feeling around the edges. And they're doing this most of the episode. And I really like how they're doing it. It feels very kid-like.
Yeah.
Feels very, I really want to know, but I'm also very scared to find the answer out.
Yeah, because we're two very tough girls. And what does it mean if we actually secretly love each other? And we're
or
very
worse,
tough.
What if
so
you don't?
If
you
only know? One of us loves and the other, it's like, they're a tough person. What are they going to do? You know, like, now I'm not saying that they're going to beat. I'm saying that, like, you know, they're going to make you feel real bad. They're going to make you feel like a fucking idiot.
And it could, you know, end the relationship.
Because
that changes it fundamentally. And if the other person is not on board with that change, can go south real fast.
But this is like Ellie clearly sees that, like, you are building pipe bombs. We've seen what pipe bombs do into the QZ in the first two episodes. I am going to be a Fedra employee, if not an officer, and these bombs are going to go be aimed towards me
or
the people I care about. And that's a huge fucking problem.
Absolutely. Yeah, especially when she's just kind of acknowledged, yeah, I want a future in this, right?
Right.
Chose that second path with Kwong, so... Riley's going to Atlanta. So there's another QZ in Atlanta. I get the feeling that there's maybe a QZ in most major cities at this point.
I would think so, yeah.
And the Fireflies have a network down in the south, not just, you know, across the northern part of the country. It was interesting because I don't think in Kansas City we saw any Firefly activity whatsoever. And I don't know why. You think there were three factions fighting it out there?
Way out west. Or maybe the, like, before the Fireflies took hold, the We the People
possibly
movement had already been, and, like, there's only room for one, you know, kind of revolutionary movement.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, maybe they were Fireflies and everything but name. I don't know.
What if it's a Cold War situation where, like, if Fireflies know that there's already a resistance band inside a city, they just kind of, like, network and equip them, but they don't.
Sure.
Like, why would they go in and move their own soldiers, get caught in a crossfire when there's already someone fucking with Fedra?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Let's move on to Ellie getting halfway out of the mall before changing her mind and going back. She hears a bunch of screaming and runs toward it, only to find out that Riley is pouting in a Halloween store. And the screaming was a decoration. They talked about why Riley's leaving, because she's searching essentially for a family she lost when her parents died. And Ellie tells Riley that she'll miss her. And then they throw on Halloween masks and have a dance party. And Ellie asks Riley once again not to go. And she agrees this time, which... it's kind of surprising to me, which is when Ellie finally gets up the courage to kiss her, and it seems to go over pretty well. Unfortunately, that infected from earlier finds and attacks them. Ellie manages to kill it, but not before they're both bit, and they decide to be all poetic and shit and lose their minds together.
Yeah, I'm glad that they made Ellie decide to go back before they're screaming, because I thought that would have felt manipulative and cheap.
Yeah. Yeah, it tells you that the way they're leaving each other didn't sit right with her.
Yeah, yeah, and she's going back there. I did like the jump scare, because there's a couple good ones. Like I said, when the corpse guy, the whiskey donator, fell through the floor, I thought that was a pretty good jump scare, because I was expecting him to get up. Mm-hmm. You know, anytime I see, like, honestly, Laura Croft and Nathan Drake have ruined that for me. Like, anytime I see a corpse in an adventure video game, I just, like, God damn, it's going to be a zombie. It's going to get up and attack me. It's going to be a mummy. It's going to be some kind of weird Nazi submarine zombie. Something. So, like, I was just waiting for this guy to get up and try something. He didn't.
Ever since the original Resident Evil, that's what did it for me. It was like,
oh, right.
Every time you step over one of those fucking corpses, it's going to grab your ankles.
It's
going to
bite your ankle for sure. But yeah, I thought that was a pretty effective jump scare. Kind of, I like the whole family thing, because, you know, that's the story of this, is that Ellie has, against all odds, in the last 3 to 4 months, discovered another family.
Yeah, this is probably the best part of the episode.
A teeny tiny family, but one that it fits her nevertheless. And Etta James version of I Got
Before.
Yeah. Whereas this is something that Riley always acutely missed because, you know, she lost it at an age old enough to remember. That doesn't apply to Ellie, but I liked him dancing to the Etta James version, I Got You, Babe. I thought that was such a great way to tell. There's like a storytelling in this dance scene where at first it's just kind of like the novelty. There's almost like a Saturday Night Fever quality to them being up on the display cases that are lit from below. So it's like this dance way, and they're just kind of like just rocking it out. And then they got the masks on, so that's ridiculous, and they're giggling. And then you can tell even before Ellie pulls off the mask that it's starting. She's starting to feel the feelings. Oh, and yeah, it's like a little three-act play, just them dancing. I thought that was really good.
Yeah, this is the moment where Ellie finds that thing. And I think Riley finds that thing that she's been looking for, right? And it's why in this scene she agrees not to go with the Fireflies, because she's found what she thought the Fireflies were going to give her in Ellie. And this is why it's so sad. And this is why I want to see the aftermath of this event here, where they are, you know, sitting and losing their minds together. I want to see how Ellie reacts to this, because this is the first time Ellie's ever had anything to lose and is losing it actively. And there's this moment that's got to switch on in her mind where she's processing at the end of this episode, like, I'm losing the thing that I just gained that means so much to me. And I want to see the moment where she realizes that not only is she going to die having lost this thing, but she's going to live. That's the more crushing part of this, right? Is that, like, she found it. They were going to die together in this poetic, beautiful way, but she survived it somehow, miraculously. And it's so, it should be such a moment of joy, but it would be such a moment of pain for her.
Yeah.
And that all ties back into Joel, right? Like, that would make it even more powerful. And I just don't know why they didn't go there with this. Give us an extra 2 minutes of just watching them turn, watching the beauty of it turn on Ellie. And then we would really understand what Joel means to her.
And just to be clear, you're not talking about wanting to see something you've already seen. You're, because I just want people to, like, freak out that you're giving spoilers.
I don't know that I've ever played this DLC, actually.
Okay.
I'm inferring all of this. Like,
gotcha. I just want to make sure, because, like, I have, and I just update, and I just want to make sure.
Yeah, this is me speculating on, like, exactly what it must be like, right, for her to find this thing, to know that she survives this event. Like, she's bit in the same place that we see her bit. She survives it, obviously.
You want to see it in black and white, like what it, or I guess color.
And if Riley were immune, Riley would be around in episode one, right?
Yeah.
But she's not. And we hear Marlene saying stuff about, like, Riley and how she died and all that. So I think it would have made it more powerful.
We've talked a lot about Bella Ramsey and how good she is. I thought Storm Reid was a really good foil, or I guess scene partner for her. And I know she's done, I haven't seen her in anything. Like, I know she's done, I've heard she's done really good work in Euphoria, and she was in A Wrinkle Before Time, which I did not see. But I thought she did real good here. And I'm like, man, seeing this, like, all these new young stars we're seeing in Hot D and The Last of Us, and knowing that, like, we're probably going to see them develop as performers over the next 10, 15, 20 years. Pretty exciting.
Oh, man. Yeah, I'm looking forward to, like, anything that Bella
does
after this.
A new Hollywood generation is emerging. It's kind of fun to watch.
Absolutely. You mentioned, so way back in episode 3, we were talking about the music, right? With the beautiful song, which I can't remember the name of it, that they sing now, long time.
Yeah.
And I was talking about, like, Linda Ronstadt. Jesus, I better say that right. Linda, I've learned my lesson, people. Linda Ronstadt being kind of a cultural gay icon, right? For her, all the activism she did around that. And I feel like Cher is right there, too. So to play I Got You, Babe, in this moment where they are connecting and you're going to have the kiss between the two women here.
But they didn't go with the Cher version.
They did not. You're right. But it is originally a Sonny and Cher song. So
yeah, it's a more funky version. I don't know if it's the original or if Sonny and Cher were the original.
Sonny and Cher are the original.
Were they? Okay. They actually wrote it. Got it.
Mm-hmm. So I thought it was nice to have, you know, one more connection to the gay culture there with them in this scene. And then, yeah, we see Ellie, you know, pleading with Riley not to go. It's really sad. She's doing it in both timelines. She's doing it with Joel last episode. And she's doing it here. And they did a really good job of connecting those. And then it makes it more sad that Riley agrees not to go, right? Because, like...
Right. They were about to have, like...
They had some version
of post-apocalyptic happiness.
Mm-hmm.
For the next couple of years, at least. And
she was going to literally spend her life shoveling shit
so she could be with Ellie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Damn. That's sad.
Of course, knowing teenagers, she'd be 2 weeks on shit detail, moved out from the dorm room. Ellie gets a new roommate, falls in love with somebody else. And then, oh, God, I took the shit detail and said no to the Fireflies. Yeah. But, you know.
Yeah, we won't think about that.
That's what your teenage years are for, you know?
Uh-huh.
Getting your heart broken, breaking hearts, figuring all this shit out.
Totally. All right, let's go back to the
present.
This ties directly to,
this is the thesis statement, right? Mm-hmm. That there's two options. We give up and do the expedient thing, or we take every last bit of hope and chance and the seconds, minutes, hours we have alive and... we don't quit, and they hold hands and they don't give up. And we come back with Joel and, you know, that scene of her holding his hand before, like they're communicating that like, yes, you told me to run, but like, as long as you're breathing and your heart's beating, I don't know if I can do this, but as long as you're still alive and there's a chance, I can't doom you. Cause if I walk out this door, I know you're dead.
Yeah.
It's like I said, I don't think we needed it after last episode. But it's, they spent 57 minutes really underlining that point.
Totally. Yeah, we're, like you said, we're back in the present. Ellie's frantically searching the house for something to help Joel with. She finds a needle and thread and sews him up. And the other thing I like about this is that Ellie is alive here because Riley didn't let her kill herself. The option one was not on the table.
Right.
And Ellie is kind of passing that on now. You know, miracles seem to happen. It's like, it seems hopeless with Joel because they're in the middle of nowhere. He's bleeding profusely. She has no supplies or skills, maybe even to help him. But look at her. She's a miracle. If you know, she had just given up and shot herself, then we wouldn't be potentially having a hope for mankind here. So like, I think it's her kind of clinging also to this idea of miracles can happen.
If you believe, as they say, the Prince of Egypt.
And that's it, man.
That's it. This is the call. I mean, you know, if to the extent that this was and I don't know if it was. It seems like a lot of people said this was a toe tapper in like kind of like impatience, but. To the extent that it is the calm before the storm. This was the loud, clanky ride up the roller coaster hill until the floor drops out. Because I don't think people are going to have the complaints about the next 2 weeks. I think we're going to finish the season strong, and people are going to be waiting with bated breath for volume two.
Mm-hmm.
You can wait for bated breath for feedback volume later this week. It's just 2 weeks. It's not a long time to have bated breath. So that's good. TLU at baldmove.com. If you want to send in feedback, we will consider everything we have time for. We also will have probably Spore Lore and Super Spore Lore editions. So like if you want to stay at the end of that and check out some video game spoilers or speculation, you're welcome to. And then, of course, this weekend we do it all over again with the live instant take and instant talk for the penultimate episode of The Last of Us. You got to be a club member if you want to watch us record that live, and more importantly, joining on the instant talk where you can use the chat interface to make comments and talk about your theories and all that kind of stuff. Check that out, support.baldmove.com, if you want ad-free feeds as well as access to both halves of the Instant Take and Instant Talk. And watch us record it live. Finally, you can find us on twitter.com/baldmove if you want to keep up with all the great movie and TV and occasional video game content that we come out with. Because, man, there's just a ton of stuff. Where Mando starts up next week, right?
This week.
It's this week. Shit, it's this week.
I think so.
It's tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Tonight, maybe. If you, depending on how late you stay up, we've got the Yellow Jackets coming back. If you like prestige type horror things in the vein of The Last of Us, there's that. Severance is coming back real soon, which was one of the TV shows we're most excited about. So as The Last of Us is winding down, lots of Bald Move things winding up. Check it out at twitter.com/baldmove. Anyway, that'll do it for this week's main episode. We'll see you see you this Thursday for the feedback episode. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.